I'm Jody, the mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr, the doc.
And this is Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas.
We bring together the mom experience and the doc expertise to give you the information and tools you need to help make the next right decision to get your child back.
Let's dive in.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Mom and Doc Talk. We are joined today by two guests who are here to talk about something I'm really curious about and really excited to learn more about, which is neurofeedback. So I want to just dive right in and introduce you to our guests. First, we have Andrea Jones, who is have been with us before. So she might look a little familiar to you, although her background is a little bit different. She is a registered nurse, a functional hormone practitioner, and mother of a daughter with pandas. After spending 15 years working in acute care pediatrics with children of all ages and diseases, she left the medical system to find a way to support patients more holistically. She's an author, speaker, and neurofeedback practitioner whose passion is to serve her community with excellence. And she is joined today by Joshua, or Josh, who is a licensed mental health counselor who incorporates a variety of treatments, including talk therapy, EMDR, QEEG, brain mapping, family systems work, and neurofeedback. He is passionate about the growing field of neurofeedback and the many ways it can be used for treating mental and physical ailments. He has his master's in counseling from Multnomah University and a bachelor's in theology. He's board certified in neurofeedback. Did I say all that correct?
You did. Very well.
I'm not a Pacific Northwesterner, so you know.
You did great. Yeah, you did great.
Every once in a while, those things jump out and I'm like, wait a minute, there's too many M's in this word. And I get a little, like Sammamish. I can say Sammamish correctly now.
Yeah, nice. I can't even say it correctly. So,
I just have to say, we had a guest in our season two who mentioned family systems work as being something that can be really beneficial, especially in trauma. So I was really curious to see that you incorporate family systems into some of your work too. I know there's a lot of more growing awareness about it and it can be really helpful.
Sure.
But that's a distraction. That's not what we're here to talk about today. So welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thank you.
We're going to talk more and more about neurofeedback, but before that, just tell us a bit about yourselves. Whoever would like to start first, you guys can.
Josh, why don't you go first? I think they've heard from me. I can fill in little bubbles if I need to, but yeah, go for it.
Sure. Well, let's see. I did spend the first stint of my life studying theology at Multnomah University, which was, you know, one of my first loves and passions and interests. Following that period of time, I ended up doing a bit of anti-human trafficking work and work overseas in Nepal, where I was in the 2007 Civil War, where I did some anti-trafficking work over there for a number of months during that summer. Came back home and worked with some local agencies and eventually ended up working in rehab before joining the military and doing frontline medical work, where I was an orthopedic specialist for Walter Reed and did medical triage life flights for the frontline in DC. I did that for a little while, finished off my military career with the kind of a trip to Haiti doing a medical clinic. And then transitioned into getting a master's in counseling, and now I'm doing neurofeedback. So I've been doing that for, I lost track, I don't know, 10 to 12 years, maybe at least. So,
were you Army?
Yeah, Army. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Time, we actually closed Walter Reed and moved it to Bethesda Walter Reed, and so we ended up becoming Triforce at the time. So I actually watched as we moved away from doing Army-centered life flight reception to being like Air Force, Navy, and Army total. So I was actually under the Navy command at the end, and I was in charge of sailors as an Army soldier, which is pretty funny.
Well, so I was in the Navy, and but I was in Navy intelligence, and so I spent the only time in the military that I spent on a Navy base and working for Navy people was boot camp. Everything else was at Army and Air Force bases. So it's just
super weird, right?
But that's not what we're here to talk about either. Go ahead, Andrea, tell us a little bit about yourself, because there's going to be some people who haven't heard your other episodes.
Okay. Well, I don't want to bore people to death. But yes, so I'm Andrea Jones. I am a registered nurse. I spent actually the majority of, 2004 to 2018-ish at Randall Children's Hospital working in pediatric acute care, PICU and NICU, doing a lot of everything that you don't ever want to see, right? Mm-hmm. And left the medical system right around the time my daughter was diagnosed with pandas. And it kind of was a forced transition, but ended up being a really good transition to where it really kind of catapulted me into doing more functional medicine work. And then in, let's see, 2022, I got COVID. Supposedly, I actually never got tested, but I had all the symptoms for it, developed a whole host of symptoms, which thankfully Resilience was able to help me get on top of my feet again. But that's when I reached out to my friends, Josh and Michelle, who I actually went to high school with, his wife, Michelle. I was like, hey, I'm still having really bad, like, neurological symptoms, like brain fog, not sleeping. Can we just, like, throw on a cap and see what's happening in my nervous system right now? And so, I've always loved neurofeedback. I've done it postpartum, and done it a little bit with my girls in different stages. And so fell in love with doing neurofeedback for people.
I'm super excited that you guys are here today because I'm very much a student. I know nothing about neurofeedback. I don't even know how I got this far into the PANS and after PANS journey without knowing anything about neurofeedback, but I'm glad that I get to learn some stuff today. So let's start at the very, very beginning. What is neurofeedback and how does it work?
Mm-hmm. So neurofeedback is learning the operant or autonomic conditioning of brain waves through a brain-computer interface or biofeedback. That's a very technical explanation. It's a short explanation, though. So if you have maybe some reference point from biofeedback, that can be helpful. Or if you have some reference point through brain-computer interfacing, that can be helpful. If you don't, people are still kind of lost even after saying that. It's like, okay, that's fair. So we'll start over. We do have to sometimes backtrack quite a bit because there's not a lot of reference points sometimes for some of the things that we talk about in the brain. It can be like talking about quantum physics. You're like, whoa, none of that relates to anything. Like, yep, that's true. You know, we could talk a lot about how it's hard to learn things that there's no relationship to. Mm-hmm. Whenever you, I'll use an analogy. Whenever you go to like a high school band and the band director's not there and they're all playing their different songs, if even just one of those band members that's playing all the different songs, practicing whatever they're practicing, if one of them starts playing in cadence with your footstep, you'll kind of orient to it pretty quickly. So our brain's pretty good at associating cause and effect, even to like my footsteps are relating to what this one person out of 50 people is playing. And we have that kind of cocktail effect is what we call it, this kind of paired association. Our brain kind of makes this establishment of like, that person's connecting to me and associating their beat to my footstep. Okay, that's what's happening. So we're pretty good at doing that. And there's a conscious awareness in that example, though that's not required, nor is it likely to happen in some cases. What we're doing in neurofeedback is we're actually giving some rhythm and connection to some brain frequency using computer response, using audio, visual, or tactile response. And it's going to dance with that rhythm in real time to trigger a paired association and some learning in the brain. And we do that to create an effect that is desirable. So you could look at like the ADHD population. There isn't one thing that is like ADHD. You know, our diagnostic manual on the mental health side is a descriptive adaptation. It's not a prescriptive model. You know, that's a whole nother podcast, okay? But that's right. A big problem. Okay, so yeah. We use the word diagnosis. Doesn't really mean much, okay? You know, even though we use the same word, you know, that we do in medicine, it means very little. It's a descriptive adaptation. So when we look at these people, there's a lot of things causing their attention deficits. A third of them look like they're having migraines or headaches. 20% of them look like they're drowsy when they're not drowsy. 10% of them look like they're OCD, but they don't have OCD, you know, and there's a whole bunch of different groups in there that do a bunch of different things, okay? So when we look at the mechanism that's propagating poor attention and we train it so that when they behave more normal, they get more light, more sound, and more vibration, they autonomically learn to normalize their brain function. And if they can sit in front of that computer with the sensors on their head and getting that positive feedback loop for about 20 hours, they will normalize their attention generally. And that effect is permanent. And that's probably the easiest way to explain it.
So as I was sharing with you guys before we got started recording, I mm-hmm. have done the tiniest bit of neurofeedback mm-hmm. training in mm-hmm. naturopathic medical school. So I did right. a couple of rotations, like clinical rotations, where mm-hmm. I actually was working with people to go through the process. Mm-hmm. And then did some training in both biofeedback and neurofeedback in like an elective course. Right. So I've got the littlest bit of neurofeedback training. So I'm in the disadvantaged. I'm in the disadvantaged place that like I understand enough of it that mm-hmm. like I don't know if we're missing something that
that's okay. Brand new person I'm a safe person to be wrong near. I won't be punitive.
You know? Super high level. It's just retraining the brain, right?
Yeah.
And it's not the same kind of training as other things. And there is a very distinct difference between like biofeedback and neurofeedback. And the reasons why are because when they discovered neurofeedback, which was discovered by NASA studying cats using, it's a long story. It might be worth telling the story about Barry Sternman's cats and NASA injecting rocket fuel into cats and there's these cats that just won't die. Yeah. I know, it's a crazy
That's
story.
Like a whole other, yeah. It's a good one though. Yeah.
We accidentally created cats that were super resilient to epilepsy, and that was not done on purpose. It was done on accident, and then those cats were later donated from UCLA Medical School to NASA for studying monomethylhydrazine exposure because they were having a rocket fuel leak in the cabin of the space shuttle. So they decided to rapidly try to determine how at risk the astronauts were by injecting rocket fuel into these cats. And they did a cohort of 50 cats, injected them with 10 milliliters of monomethylhydrazine rocket fuel. 40 out of 50 got unstable brains via the EEG and developed facial tics and oversalivation. 10 cats, no symptoms. They upped the dose to 20 milliliters, 30 milliliters, 40 milliliters, and eventually a 50 milliliter dose. And they had essentially 40 cats were dead or dying of grand mal seizures. But 10 cats still had less than a 10 milliliter response after 150 milliliter exposure. And this doesn't make any sense because not only do we have two different groups relative, you have two different bell curves with two different peaks. We have two bell curves that aren't even touching. There's no debate that there are two separate groups here. You know, we have a group of cats that are dead and a group of cats that are just starting to get sick and they're on the same dose. This doesn't make any sense. So they did an audit and found that the 10 cats that were very resilient to the toxins had all come from UCLA study. Though they had all come from UCLA, they had been claimed not to have been studied. That was the problem. Mm-hmm. And so they went further and essentially accused Barry Sternman of ruining the NASA study. And that's when it had been determined that they had not in fact been a clean donation, but mm-hmm. they had been in fact been involved in a observational study where a light bulb was essentially activated whenever they turned on a beta rhythm on the top of the head. So mm-hmm. this was designed to help the researcher associate cat behavior to brain behavior, making it an observational study. The idea wasn't for the light bulb to influence the cat's brainwaves, though. The light bulb was a research aid to help the researcher determine the cat's mental state and behavioral associations. And they eventually published on it, which is actually what made the lab more well-known, which is what made NASA reach out to them 6 years later. Mm-hmm. There's a couple things in that study that are really, really alarming. One was the study was 6 years after the fact, and biofeedback had never been observed to last more than 6 months in a cat or even 2 years in an adult, you know, human. Mm-hmm. And so there's no precedent for a biofeedback mechanism lasting 6 years. Also, we'd never seen it demonstrated in any convincing way on a brainwave. And so this was very strange. Mm-hmm. So Barry Sternman used his arguments as leverage to convince NASA to donate some monomethylhydrazine rocket fuel. He ended up creating 7 different cohorts of cats so he could vindicate himself. Mm-hmm. But all he ended up doing was proving that if you reflect the brainwave of the cat using the light bulb, that they will actually become resilient to toxins. And he did that with 7 different cohorts and eventually moved on to humans. And we're in the 1960s, okay? Like, just so we be clear, this is the 1960s. It did not end up in clinical work until the 90s. So we have... So this is our book mm-hmm. on efficacy studies. So if you know what an efficacy study is, these are our meta-analysis and proof claims. This is just
for anybody who's listening, it's like 2 inches thick, right?
Two or three. Yeah, it's pretty.
So this is a very large book. This just covers the meta-analysis studies that we like. Okay. So neurofeedback's not very well known because there's not that many practitioners, but that's because it's been in laboratories for the last, like, it was in laboratories for 30 years before we ended up doing clinical work. And there's this interesting argument of, like, trying to dismiss some of the first 40, 50 years of research. Well, that's some of our best work, though. Yeah. You know, yeah. I don't know that there's any rationalization for ignoring it, you know.
No, it's interesting that's how they found neurofeedback, because what it's really known for more is like mental health stuff. And what you're sharing is with the resilience to toxin and toxic exposure. Yeah.
We have an efficacy rating of 4 out of 5 for epilepsy right now. Yeah. Yeah. It has an efficacy rating of 5 out of 5 for ADHD.
Okay.
So,
All right. Well, let's dive in just a little bit further. Like I said, I've got the tiniest bit of training in neurofeedback. I do know that there's different types that are used, like different approaches. Can you tell us a little bit about the different types and if they're all equally effective?
Yeah. So there are lots and lots of different types of neurofeedback. They are definitely not all equally effective. When we talk about an efficacy rating, we're talking about a specific type of neurofeedback, specific protocols that are relative either to a disorder or to be blunt, a disorder and neuromarker. So there's a lot to consider. You have to know a lot about the research to know when a particular protocol applies or modality applies. You know, you could say, well, how often do clinics actually practice that way? It's like, I don't know, 10-20% of the time. So there's
not
a
enough.
Legitimate concern.
Yeah.
Not enough
of the time. Yeah.
We have a pretty high standard at our clinic where we want our staff to at least bring into the initial conversation what's the most evidence-based approach first, and then two, what's your clinical experience for what we're seeing in the room, and then have both of those conversations with the family before you make your decisions. Most clinics, as might be suspected, there is kind of just the tool they have. They might have a method, which is what they'll call a method. I won't list one, but they have a method and they just kind of use that one tool on everything. And while that's likely to help a percentage of people that come in the door, it may not help all of them as much as it could, and it may not help as many people as it could. And when it fails, you will not know necessarily if it would have otherwise failed if you didn't use an evidence-based approach.
So the reason I asked is because I was trained in like very specific protocols for like you said, for specific diagnoses.
Yes.
And so it was different for different people.
The
and
problem
then when I
with
got
that
out into the world,
what is a diagnosis?
Right. And so we like did the intake on the person. We had their diagnosis. So it wasn't like you came in, you just like check off what you want. And like, it wasn't like McDonald's or something.
Yeah.
Right. But so there was an intake to determine what was most appropriate and looking at the QEEG so that we saw what was going on with their brainwaves and made sure it correlated with the symptoms and then found the appropriate approach based off of the totality of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then I get out here in the world and I meet people who are doing neurofeedback, and they're using approaches sometimes that are like one size fits all. And they're saying, you don't have to go through all of that. You just have to put the electrodes on and it's just going to balance. So no matter what you got, the system's going to figure it out and it's going to bring you into balance. I'm like, it's,
And let me guess, it's side effect free and it helps everybody, right?
That's what they're saying. And I'm just like, I'm looking at it sideways and I'm just curious.
There's only one thing that does that. We call it the placebo.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about today, and the approach you're coming from, is not that like everybody can do whatever it's going to balance. And it really has to be based off of an intake, qualitative EEG, and then evidence-based protocols. That's the perspective that you're answering from. Is that?
Yeah. Now we do allow for like an extra layer of like, okay, there's the intake, there's the assessments, there's the QEG. And then we're also going to say, also clinically, there's another layer that we're going to say, here's the evidence-based protocols. Here's also clinically what we also tend to see as valid and useful. So what does my experience as a practicing provider say, as well as what's the research say? We're going to bring both of those to the table and have a conversation with the family, but we're going to do that with informed consent. Okay. Right. So we can be
and it's going to be different for different people based
Very
on
much
what
so.
You're seeing.
100%.
So it's not.
We usually go with the evidence-based approach. Okay.
Big secret.
Usually.
There.
Okay.
My biggest concern is like when we get I feel like there's too many people that like, no matter what you got going on, this is going to help you. And it's the same protocol for everybody, just like cranking people through That is not what we're talking about. We were talking
well,
about
the reason why
approach.
you see those alternative
Right.
models are because they don't know how to do it in a more complex, sophisticated, difficult way. They don't have the knowledge base or aptitude to do it. And they don't want to admit that, I think. And maybe the distributors sold them on a system that was very narrow in focus.
That's what I think. I like I, my, in my
Yes.
most generous interpretation, I think that people that they are out truly wanting to help,
Yeah.
but they just I don't know, don't have the extensive amount of training or experience, so they don't understand that they're the value and the importance of having something really specific. Which comes to my next question, because what we're talking about with here and our primary focus is pans and pandas, which is so variable. I mean, if you see one kid who has pans, you've seen one kid who has pans, and like it's just so variable and so complex. So I'm just curious what your experience has been with pans and pandas, and other immune mediated or inflammation mediated conditions, and like how effective it is.
Yes. So with PANS pandas, I do like a system approach where we've got a whole treatment team. So I think that's a good disclaimer. I've seen a number of things work. And so I don't know what your particular podcast has found useful. I don't want to step on anybody's toes. But I'm humble enough to know that there's a lot I don't know. I think the first time I ran into pandas was very, very, very humbling. It was many years ago. It was at least 10 years ago. Because maybe I might tell that story. I'll skip it now, but I might tell that story because it's fascinating. But I ended up having to put my foot in my mouth. It was just like, whoa. The parents ended up going with a medical approach that showed significant improvement that would have only worked if PANS was real. This is long before it had any kind of medical validation. And it was like, boom, it worked. It was like, what? You know? And it was like, at that moment, I was like, I'm going to become a conspiracy theorist, I think, because that's real. It was very like, I don't know what's happening to me because yeah, this happened, my world got bigger. Anyways, when we do the brain maps, we see frontal lobe asymmetries. We see frontal lobe beta spindling, which is a sign of cytokines or inflammation, which is, to be blunt, like can be really, really normal stuff. So I'm not trying to like freak people out. You see that in like migrainers. You see it in, people with concussions, you see it in people with bipolar, you see it in people with schizophrenia, you see it in cases with mood disorder, you see it in some sleep disorders. So it's not to be like overly panicky. You can get it from just having a flu, okay, temporarily. Okay. So really we're using a scary, maybe hot button word, but it's also really normal in the brain. But that being
So
said,
I'm
it's
a
like
migrainer who has a migraine right now, and I missed the word. What was the scary word that might be happening in my brain right now?
Inflammation.
Oh, just inflammation. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well,
In my frontal lobe.
I'll get scolded on a regular basis from doctors for using it, just to be
Right here.
clear. And it's like yes, and it's
Well, it's not a
also not.
diagnostic term, right? So it should be, I don't know why people freak out about it, but yeah, we're just
The amount of
trying to be
if I had a dime
careful.
for every angry voicemail I had from a doctor, you know. So I'm trying to be careful about how I use it, but there is a really beautiful book that details the more modern perspective on inflammation in the brain called The Angel and the Assassin. I highly recommend reading it for practitioners. It's a brutal read, but it does help you understand how the
Amazing
brain's immune
book.
system is a very different immune system than the rest of the body. Very, very useful information. You have to contend with it differently. So we see frontal asymmetries, we see cingulate disruption, which is the control center for the frontal lobe. We see beta spindling in the frontal lobe. All these things suggest executive function issues, cognitive rigidity. You're going to see symptoms like OCD, oppositional defiance. You can see, again, this kind of like in cytokine-driven response. And so it does feel like, could there be an infection? Was like what the PANS people have always said, and they've always gotten pushback from the medical community. It's like, I don't know. I mean, it kind of seems like that could be fair. We didn't have all this stuff on spindling beta nailed down. If we had, maybe we would have been in the fight earlier to help you guys. But it seems like you got there.
So it sounds like that neurofeedback can be effective when there is evidence of inflammatory processes happening in the brain, because some of the things that you're using to make decisions for treatment and seeing things change through treatment are things that are associated with inflammatory
You have to
response.
Be careful with neurofeedback, because it's kind of like exercising the brain. When there's reduced circulation, I hate using the word inflammation, but it is fair. But when the circulation is deficient for one reason or the other, and inflammation is going to reduce circulation. The reason why I don't like neurofeedback to be the only approach is because asking the brain to kind of get up and move and exercise it with neurofeedback alone is kind of like sending someone with what can only be like an analogy, like someone with asthma on a jog. It's like, okay, how much do you want someone with asthma to go for a jog? And it's like, if you have asthma and you go for a jog, that's kind of good, but only to an extent. Jogging too much with asthma is dangerous, right? Okay, well, getting too much exercise in the brain when there's circulatory deficits is also a little dangerous. And so we get very, very large ab reactions from our PANS and PANDAS cases. So you're like, whoa, that's really hard. So what's the goal? Well, the goal is to try to calibrate your neurofeedback to be just enough exercise to kind of push the nervous system like you would somebody with asthma. How much exercise should somebody with asthma do? And the answer is just enough so that they are stressed but not, you know, destabilized, okay? And you have to find that balance with neurofeedback. And that can be extremely limiting unless you have extra things on board to support them, which is why it's best to have a treatment team. And so we found things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy to be really great, because you can then kind of come in with neurofeedback with a bigger POW. And you don't have to worry too much about getting those cells firing off too much and burning too much oxygen. If the plasma platelets are carrying oxygen, you don't have to worry about them running out of oxygen. So we do run into having more side effects in PANS or PANDAS for that reason. And that's a bit of a concern.
Yeah. And I would just add to that, that when we have an ab reaction, I look at it now, obviously having walked through all of the years of homeopathic treatment, like an aggravation, like, oh, it's presenting some information. And this is what I instruct our clients on too. Like, every reaction or response that you have to neurofeedback is useful information. We try not to drive a whole lot of meaning from it. They're emotionally attached to how they feel after, like same way we do with homeopathy, right? But we try to help them to kind of parse out, like, what does that ab reaction actually mean? Because one of the benefits of doing neurofeedback on a child with PANS, or like and Josh, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like an autoimmune, any kind of inflammatory response, is the action on the microglia in the brain. And that's what the angel and the assassin talks about, is it helps to regulate the microglial system in the brain, which we know is really like dysfunctionally active in kids with PANS or PANDAS. So it's the same thing of like any treatment that you do, you have to weigh like the potential benefit. Like, there's going to be some tension in healing, and so we want to weigh the potential benefit of this process with how ready their brain is to heal at that point.
There's actually a lot of interesting things to be concerned with, like the balance of, like, your microglia are these very, very small cells in the brain that serve one of three purposes, and they only do one at a time. They have the default mode when they're born. They kind of clear out toxins from the brain, and they move things down the spinal cord, and they're only activated by your sensory motor rhythm during deep sleep in sleep spindles. And they kind of cycle through your brain, and they kind of collect things, and they dump them down the spinal cord, okay? That's when they're not being activated to do anything else. That's their default mode. If they get activated for any other reason, they switch into what's called their M1 state, which is a pro-inflammatory state. And they do this for all kinds of reasons. What do? They create inflammation on purpose. Fantastic. And they actually make cytokines, which is a little annoying. And they'll produce cytokines, and they'll just kind of do this, and you'll see the neuromarkers for that, front to beta spindles, and other things, which is unfortunate. They'll do this when you have a flu or a cold, just to make you feel tired, so you'll lay down. So, you know, the vagal nerve is responsible for making the brain microglial kind of match whatever physical inflammation you have going on in the body a little bit. But they'll do that on their own for other reasons too. Then their third state, their M2 state, they have to be switched over to in deep sleep as well, is their anti-inflammatory state. And that's when they'll actually go around and collect cytokines and clean them up. And then you have to essentially, you know, make new microglial cells to get new janitorial cells that will clean up the toxins. The problem when you have like something like PANS or PANDA is, I imagine, and I'm not like a neurobiologist,
right?
So, but I wonder sometimes if there's kind of this imbalance of like, I need some default janitorial microglial cells,
yeah,
okay, but I also need some inflammatory cells to restrict the movement of the infection.
Yes.
So, but the more I have of one, the less I have of the other. So wouldn't it be great if I could have more of all of them? And how do you do that? Well, you train up the sensory motor rhythm. That's how you get more of everything. That's what Barry did with the cats. Those cats had more of everything. And you can do that. That's what happens when you train up the sensory motor rhythm. You get a lot more mobilization and a lot more activation of a lot more.
Yeah.
And that's the theory behind why Barry's cats were so much better at regulating, you know, super high doses of toxins.
Yeah.
So,
So it sounds like the primary risk that, as you guys are sort of describing it right now, is that it could go be too much too fast, and you could essentially make PANS flare worse. Which I will 1000% validate. My team and I, we talk every Friday, and we were just talking literally last week about this, and about the various things that we see trigger flares in kids, and neurofeedback came up, and every single one of us has seen it. And so I will be perfectly honest with you. I've had some challenges sometimes as somebody who is a fan of neurofeedback. Some challenges giving thumbs up to people with starting neurofeedback for their kids. I have generally focused, well, before we go on to this part, are there any other risks that we haven't talked about other than like basically it could
I put 9 pages in my next edition of my book that I haven't published yet on side effects. 9 pages.
Okay.
So
are
there
any,
like
any like
four
specific
other
risks for doing neurofeedback with kids with PANS aside from possibly causing an accident, or like a
there's
thing.
A list. I could go over a list.
Yeah.
There's a lot to consider. You know, we already kind of covered how you have to get the right protocols, right? So it's like, okay, we don't want to do just anything with anybody. We don't want to overtrain, especially if we have a hypoxic ischemia. Okay. That's the technical term for if we train with vascular ischemia, we could end up re-injuring them. We could end up causing problems. Yes. We could exacerbate the problem. Definitely. That's two. Okay. The third is you sometimes need a counterbalance to a protocol. So some protocols over-respond, the brain can over-respond to. Okay, so it's like, okay, this protocol, like the sensory motor rhythm we talk about training, which helps the microglial and helps the brain manage resources and detox and reduce inflammation. Your brain can over-respond to that and turn off the frontal lobe, which is fine, but you have to learn how to turn it back on. Otherwise, they'll get really, really disinhibited, or they'll get really, really, really sedated. And so if you don't have the counterbalance protocol ready for that one, you're going to get some pretty funny side effects. You also might need to do some frequency modulation because people don't have the same sensory motor rhythm spindle. There's one case in the UCLA lab where they found an autistic boy had a rhythm that was 10 hertz. And that's nowhere near the band we used to train. And so it's like, whoa, what do you do now? It's like, you gotta be ready to go find the frequencies that you want to train, and you need to be ready to calibrate to the frequencies that you're looking for. Okay. I'm sure there's one more side effect cause that I'm missing.
Well, I just, while you're searching your brain, the thing that I'm really drawn to is just how important that example you just gave is to making sure you know the individual that you're working with, and like that's why I think there's far more risk personally in doing basically blind treatment, where you're not you don't understand what's happening with the brain, because the reality is From what I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can have three people, much like you, I say, if you've seen one case of PANS, you've seen one case of PANS. You can have three people sitting in your office who have the same concern. They all have OCD and anxiety. And their brain mapping is going to look very different.
100%.
And so like, if you just went based off of symptoms, you could inadvertently up-train the anxious state in somebody.
100%.
So easy. So easy. I kind of, and people don't come to me because they look exactly the way they expect, you know, generally. Like if they maybe they would have gone to their doctor, the doctor would have given them the med that meets, you know, 80%, and it would have worked great. Mm-hmm. People come to you because they've had difficulty somewhere along the way, and they don't quite, they're not quite in that 80% of normal. And so when I look at people, they are never what you'd actually expect. And they're always pretty unique and pretty fun looking. When I do random brain maps at universities of students, they're kind of exactly what you'd expect them to be. Mm-hmm. And the way they describe themselves looks exactly the way that you'd expect based on the textbooks. But the people who come into your clinic, no way, man. They don't look what they're always kind of the unicorns because that's what brought them in. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that's really, really important to remember. That variety will really catch you off guard. You have to be very, very, very sharp. Yeah. I could give any amount of examples you want.
But this is where it's just like most of the side effects are going to come in because you're either going too fast or you're not necessarily
the wrong protocol
approach that's appropriate for that particular brain, or you're not balancing because there can be competing things that show up on brain mapping that sometimes you need to like up train this and down train this other one, and that need to have like the correct balance. Is that
I do consults, you know, internationally, you know, for all kinds of cases, and every now and then I'll look at a case, and everyone who's assessed this individual case, they'll be looking at you know, this person's got too much theta, this person's got too much beta, and it's like no, this frequency band that is a particular mechanism in the brain derived from this mechanism, so like thalamocortical derived alpha, is too fast. It's 14 hertz, you know, which is usually 8 to 12 or something like that. I know this is going over most people's heads, but because it was sped up, or maybe it doubled because of an injury or something like that, everybody is kind of taking too many shortcuts in their assessments. And they're saying, oh, this is beta, or this slowed down, or they're not seeing it slow down, they're seeing it as theta. And it's like, no, this is, you have to look at not just the frequency, but you have to look at the mechanism behind the frequency. And you actually have to do some trace analysis and figure out where is it coming from. And it does matter where it's coming from. It does matter how it's behaving. And you have to identify what is it, not just what frequency is it, but what is it exactly, because it matters a lot. And that's maybe the last version, is that if you've misidentified what the component is, you're going to give them the wrong treatment. That happens all the time.
One of the things that I am curious about is the timing, because I ask about the, or this is something that I recommend when parents are really considering neurofeedback. So I find that if we, especially with homeopathy, which can help like balance things out, reduce inflammation, get a more appropriate immune response, and increase tolerance and resilience for lots of things. I find that if we get to a certain point, and it's not like this exact, like, oh, once you've reached this point or this amount of time or whatever,
the magic
like
number, ready, yeah,
you know, but like when we start to get some, like a general sense that they've got a better, they're in a better place, I find that they tolerate neurofeedback much better.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
It, so it 100%. Works, it works faster. It's easier. It's just like generally more effective.
I agree with you. I you know, it's early in my day, but I had an intake earlier today and I did not recommend neurofeedback for that intake.
Okay.
You know, I recommended that they go do other things and then, you know, consider us after they've done those things because of the same exact reason. Like I can foresee that we're gonna have a lot of side effects.
Which aren't necessarily beneficial healing therapeutic.
I do process, think that we could get a lot of progress. That Goldilocks zone where you're straining, stressing the nervous system, and it will be healing for them to stay in that zone, is tedious, hard work for us, which is fine. But there are other ways to get there that are less dramatic, that are easier, like hyperbaric oxygen therapy is a cool trick. If you've studied it, it's very, very useful. Sometimes if you're looking at like injuries, you know, go do that, you know, follow the right protocols. If you do the right protocols, that kind of just resolves a lot of stuff. Now for pandas, I don't think that applies, but I don't know. So I would say that that's different. Probably like,
I think that the reality is like you said, it's exercising the brain and it's not work, right? Like
there is work
involved in neurofeedback. So even if the brain could handle it, even if you didn't have to worry about any possible adverse effects, like it is just like these kids are so depleted and these families are so depleted. So like the time and the work that has to go into it for it to be effective. I feel like it's just people tend to do better. We tend to see fewer flares if we've moved through some things. And that I'm glad to hear though, that there's ways that you can address things too. And it sounds like some of the people who've probably had the worst flares from it might not have been working with somebody who takes such a deep dive into all of the things contributing.
Talk to those of us PANS families that heard the words adverse effects and are like, nope. There's things that can be done. There's ways you guys work through it. There's things like you were talking about a second ago. There's things to be done. That's not something we should.
They're the same adverse side effects that you're already seeing. So for example, like you ever had your kid go out and get too much exercise and you see them kind of have a bit of a meltdown later, you know, like those kinds of issues, those meltdowns, those sensory overloads, those difficulty sleeping, the irritability. It's the same kind of thing. It's just more obvious when all they did was sit down for 30 minutes and basically engaged with the little computer interface, the little animation, or watched a cartoon, you know, did something fairly benign. And it's very obvious that that was an impact, that had an impact on them in kind of a very acute way. But if you see them have a little meltdown after a sporting event, you don't really think of that as being unusual, because you realize there was a lot of endorphins and you realize there was a lot of exercise and you realize that there was a lot of variables that contributed to that. And so it doesn't seem that big of a deal to you, but it's the same kind of overactivation. And it is part of what helps the brain potentially heal, but it can also be too much. And we don't try to regulate necessarily the regular rhythms in life that exacerbate that, but they do happen.
So what do you do when you see these? Is it just like a wait it out? Is it adjust the protocol?
No,
is there a protocol you do to like reverse
it? We adjust.
We definitely adjust. We always take it very, very seriously. And the type of the responses that we're getting, often, though, we can get confused. Can tell us what types of changes to make. So there's a difference between over-arousal and under-arousal. Though with kids, you do get paradoxical responses, like disinhibition is a good example of a kid who gets hyper when they get tired. Well, great. That's a little confusing. Yep, definitely. Moms have good intuition, though. If you ask mom the question, was your kid too flat or too fizzy? Moms can kind of hone in on it and go like, oh, they were too flat. Like, oh, okay, so let's change the reward frequency up. And we do have to kind of make an educated guess, and we can guess wrong for a session or so. Eventually we get it right, where are we changing the reward frequency, or do we need to add the counterbalance? And we have to figure out what's really needed here. Usually we're pretty good at keeping the variables clean, unless it's like the very first session. But usually we're pretty good. There's only like three things we manage. One is the reward frequency. So we're changing what we're trying to encourage in the brain. That can have a very strong effect on activation in the brain. And then the length of the treatment can have an effect on how much activation occurs. And then, the balance or counterbalance, is like the third variable, apart from the whole protocol itself. But those are essentially what we have to work with, are those four choices essentially. Generally, we do pretty good of keeping those variables straight and not getting ourselves too confused.
So just so I understand, as I'm having these conversations with people, if they do have any of these adverse events or like flares triggered by neurofeedback, are they going to be in that state until the next session? Is it going to settle down?
Great question.
Great question.
It usually settles down pretty quickly. I've been doing this for a long time. I've lost count of how many clients I've had, at least thousands. You know, the most dramatic responses I've had, you know, wore down after maybe 3 days. Most of the time, it's a lot quicker than that, though. So, but if you want to, you know, this is kind of a universal, like if our clients ever had that issue, we would want them to call us. We'd have them come back at no charge. And it, not because we couldn't charge them, but because we just wouldn't, we want to not discourage them from calling. You know, it's right. like, don't let money
getting
stop
the help
you
they
from coming
need.
Back.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Some, we'll get somebody to fix it, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And I have seen some flares last longer, but it was in people who were only doing that, or they weren't at the place that their body was really ready to handle it yet.
Yeah.
And we do often like shorten sessions as well. Mm-hmm. Like we'll start really, really short, like maybe 10 or 15 minutes of brain training, and then slowly, gradually, as we see that, that can also be a way that we can mitigate those kind of reactions too.
Corey Hammond did a big study last year on side effects. He's probably the foremost expert on side effects and neurofeedback. And his cohort of children showed 100% of the subjects reported side effects.
Wow.
And so we just kind of expect it in kids. They need highly customized protocols, and whatever is standard to start with out of the box, you know you're going to have to adjust it. You can adjust it some amount to some degree, based on their QEG, but you know that you're going to have to tinker with it a little bit. Just guaranteed. Kids like to be a little finessed, and their brain is going to want you to shift it a little bit here and there. So it is what it is. And once you know that and you start looking for it, sure enough, that's what you're going to see. Kids 100%. Now kids also respond the best to neurofeedback too. So they're just sensitive, which is fine. And we're not talking about huge side effects. We're talking about pretty mild stuff.
Okay.
So let's switch from talking about the tough stuff to the good stuff. What kind of improvements can someone expect to see with neurofeedback?
Well, I could tell you my story. I was injured in the military, training injury. It's a long story. I had developed something called torticollis, which is a muscle skeletal disorder. I was told by the president's own specialist that I had no chance of going into remission, and that the regular, you know, 2-3 times a week of physical therapy was just intended to slow the degradation. My left ear was stuck on my left shoulder, so I actually was contorted to look like this. I was trying to treat myself for migraines, and the torticollis essentially just vanished, which is hard to explain. And it's hard to wrap your head around. I was having huge issues with the military. So it's hard to explain that too, as well. I'm honorably discharged. I have not a single counseling note on my record, so I have no disciplinary action, but I don't have any VA benefits, and I don't have any GI Bill, and I don't have any medical benefits from any of this. It's a long story. I may have blown the whistle one too many times. this is some evidence that maybe I made somebody angry. So I needed to find a solution for this because I didn't have like a viable way forward in life. But in trying to treat myself for migraines, the torticollis vanished one day, just vanished pretty early on in my career. And I'd moved into private practice because I didn't have enough sick days to cover the flare-ups. Because I probably ended up bedridden at least 3 days a month minimum from the flare-ups from the torticollis. I was unable to get out of bed. So it was a very difficult situation for somebody who was very passionate about work and very passionate about mental health. I was a drug and alcohol counselor at the time. Transitioned to private practice for the purpose of trying to have some control over my own life, and happened to stumble onto a solution. Now, we do have, you know, something like 60 proof studies on things like anxiety disorders, panic disorders, epilepsy, ADHD.
OCD, I think, is in there too.
Yeah, OCD, you know, a bunch of random stuff, depression.
Mood regulation, we see a lot of improvement with mood regulation.
Insomnia.
Anxiety, sleep.
Yeah, irritable bowel, apparently. Motion sickness. PTSD. Oh, PTSD. Yeah.
PTSD.
Okay.
PTSD
is our
start
favorite.
About that one. Yeah.
Ruth
Love
Lanius
that one.
Is, yeah. Ruth Lanius' study on trauma. That one is like, so trauma looks very, 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 very specific in the brain, which is, I don't know if I can use the word specific because that's a clinical term, but it's trauma has a very distinct look is what I think I can say. And the protocols for it, so long as you kind of triage out a few phenotypes, like a few types of brains, if you just kind of like say, well, we're not going to include this, these two or three groups of people. If you just look at like 85% of the population, there's a protocol that just works so good for trauma. Mm-hmm. And this isn't well known yet, but that's going to change. And the reason why I know it's going to change is because you probably know who Bessel van der Kolk is, right? Mm-hmm. So Ruth Lanius, who's done the research for this specialized neurofeedback protocol, she's been on this speaking tour with Bessel. And so mm-hmm. I'm like, I know that Bessel's wanting this to get, you know, out there, but mm-hmm. the success rate for this protocol is extraordinarily high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's done maybe 15, 20 studies in the last 5 years alone, double-blind studies, placebo-controlled studies, two-year follow-ups. Control groups normalized after 2 years, meaning no improvement in the control group. 66 to 85% of the control, the treatment group reports 100% improvement. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So meaning 85% in some of the later studies, when mm-hmm. she figured out how to filter them better, reporting 100% improvement uh-huh. relative to no improvement in the placebo group.
Yeah,
yeah,
very cool.
I don't think we've ever seen any research in mental health get that high on trauma anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I can speak to that protocol that, mm-hmm. you know, in conjunction with homeopathy, helping mm-hmm. tremendously with the PTSD of raising a child with PANS and PANDAS, yeah, is life-changing. Like the combination mm-hmm. of the two, for me personally, with where I was at in my healing journey with homeopathy, and addressing other root causes and stuff, it was, I was like, whoa. I was like kind of going in hopeful, but it was like a whoa. That was like mm-hmm. marked, you know, permanent improvement in symptoms, which is, you know, I think we can all agree that's what we all hope for people, yeah, you know, for sure. is to not need to come back and see us forever, right? So
yeah I look at that and think about how we could actually take a version of a neurofeedback clinic that's very narrow mm-hmm. for PTSD, you know, keep it very narrow in focus, mm-hmm. Create a triage and referral protocol for any of the complex cases, and then scale right. it. Like we could put a lot of clinics out of business. Like, yeah, let's mm-hmm. do it.
Yeah. Right.
Because the success rate's so high.
Right.
You know, and I think we could do as well, because I've read all of Ruth Lanius's research really, really, really carefully. I think, and based on what I can tell from our clinic statistics, I don't see any reason why we couldn't do as at least as well as her best research. So it's like, let's do it.
All right. I'm hoping we can do some rapid mm-hmm. fire here, because we got some questions that sure. I'm sure parents are just dying to know the answers mm-hmm. to. That I'm hoping we can like I said, do a little bit of rapid fire questions for mm-hmm. people who are curious about everything that you're saying, to see if this might be something that could reasonably be a consideration for them.
Yeah. So yeah. How long does somebody need to do neurofeedback for?
I would say usually mm-hmm. like 15 to 20 weeks, mm-hmm. and we do about one session per week, I would say is fairly average, mm-hmm. Unless we are dealing with maybe something more complex, like brain injuries, sometimes a little bit mm-hmm. longer. There are variables to that, but it's usually one, maybe two sessions a week for about 3 to 4 months. And then mm-hmm. we reassess, give them a break, do some more cognitive testing, and kind of reevaluate from there. But mm-hmm. you might have more to add on that.
Yeah, the answer can be that some people might have to do it twice a week to three times a week, but that's very, very rare. And I'm going to disagree with a lot of my peers on that, because some people are going to say, hey, you got to do this more often. Like, no. A lot of people are going to say, oh, you got to do 20, 30 sessions. And I'm going to disagree with my peers on that as well. That's how research was done. That's not how clinical practice is done. And that's where I differ on my peers. We do a lot of testing and a lot of follow-up, and we're getting the results and we're doing just fine. We're being very, very aggressive and graduating our clients earlier. And part of the reason why I think that's working is because research is done, not because everybody needed 30 sessions. They did research on 30 sessions because some of them needed 30 sessions, not all of them. Mm-hmm. In clinical practice, we can modulate it more. And yeah. so we don't copy research. We accommodate the research and know that research might tell us that that could be what is needed for, you know, people. But we found that we just watch really closely and we kind of make our own decisions and we do our own follow-ups. And mm-hmm. and so we end up doing usually less sessions than other mm-hmm. clinics are going to recommend. You'll hear, or if you Google and you go on other podcasts, you'll hear people say, you know, you really need 30 or 40. You really need to do twice a week or more.
Yeah.
I'm not finding that to be the case. Okay. in yeah. my opinion. I think once or twice a week is generally good. I think about 20 sessions is a good place to recommend. We do sometimes graduate people earlier. If they're at session 3 or 4 and they're showing great gains, I might graduate them at 12. Mm-hmm. But that's because I saw early response. Mm-hmm.
And with the way mm-hmm. neurofeedback works, and when you're doing mm-hmm. an approach that is looking at the QEEG first mm-hmm. and knowing actually what's going on, you're addressing all the things at once, right? So it's not 20 weeks for insomnia, 20 weeks for OCD, no. 20 weeks. Okay, just wanted to make sure.
A lot of times one mechanism is driving a lot of these things. Right. One train is driving a lot of these symptoms. And
it's all connected, right? Yeah, just like homeopathy.
It's the nervous system. Yeah. So yeah. you address one part of the nervous system and everything else is going to.
Yeah.
Okay. Theoretically,
a lot of times we're using something called the triple network theory, which means you can look at small networks and you can look at large networks. You can even kind of look at all the networks in between. But at the very, very top, there are three networks that all the other networks fit into: salience, executive, and default mode. And uh-huh. sometimes the person's dysfunction can be described as an absence, an overexpression, or a dysfunction in one of those three large networks. And if you can correct just that, you're correcting one third, you know, like that's a lot. That's a lot mm-hmm. of the, that's a lot of real estate in the brain, and so you're moving a lot of real estate in a short period of time.
Yeah,
and so it's not like you're going in and tinkering one small thing, you know. You're shifting a third of the networks. The default mode network, you know, is a big deal. If you're missing it and you start to have it again, mm-hmm. a lot of things are going to get better.
Yeah, I would say it's probably the same as, you know, with homeopathy, when we're like, okay, main symptom is rage. And it's like, okay, why is sleeping getting fixed first? Like, why can't rage yeah. go mm-hmm. first? You know what I mean? It's the nervous system. It's all the bodies connected, like you're saying. And so a lot of times we're surprised that we address one thing and mm-hmm. something else that seems kind of peripheral gets fixed. And then, yeah. so we're keeping an eye on all of that too. Yeah.
I do think that's worth mentioning. The half of all alcoholics, by the way, are missing their default mode network. They just don't have it. And if they have 4 drinks, they start producing that brainwave that they're missing and they start to actually look normal. So if you do a brain map of an alcoholic mm-hmm. while they're drunk, they look normal. And if they sober up, they look terrible. That's actually like a way of thinking about them. You can train them to produce that brainwave without having to drink. And then they actually don't care to drink.
Yeah.
Because that's why they drank.
Well, it's sort of like sleep getting better before rage getting better. Well, their rage is probably in part because sleep is so terrible.
And yeah, 100%.
For rage to get better. So.
Yeah, 100%.
All right. Mm-hmm. So we already talked about like that there's sometimes you'll not recommend that people start neurofeedback or that they do mm-hmm. other things first. Are there any outright contraindications for doing neurofeedback?
I can think of one.
Go for it.
If the client is not ready or does not have the capacity to move through some of the emotional experience that happens with neurofeedback, doesn't happen very often, but every once in a while we'll get somebody that is not ready to go through like what sometimes comes up with neurofeedback training, wanting to feel their emotions, being willing to feel emotions that might be difficult at times. That's the one that
would be like a temporary contraindication if they're working, if they're able to work through it or through other therapies or whatever. Are there any like outright, this person should never do neurofeedback no matter what? Doesn't seem like it. You guys are pretty blank.
So
I can't think of any, but
there are some, there's a pretty gray area where, there's a pretty gray area with somebody who's had like brain surgery. I would call that a pretty, you know, distinct gray area.
So maybe if there's been brain surgery,
which is different than a brain injury,
right?
But brain surgery, that's a gray area.
Okay.
And I would agree with Andrea that if the client isn't consenting, like even if they're a kid, I don't want to do it. I'm going to say like, they don't want to do it, mom, sorry.
They're not doing it.
It's not as likely to be.
If they don't want to do it, the way that I phrase Andrea's example is if you think about yourself and you don't desire to have self-compassion, you have to be willing and wanting to have self-compassion. You don't have to have self-compassion, but you are able to be have self-compassion, but you have to want to have self-compassion.
Right.
And that's when the trauma protocols are able to do their job. Otherwise, the trauma protocols stir up more conflict if you are not desiring of self-compassion.
Got it.
And it's a very key, it's a very simple way to kind of orient people to whether or not they're ready. Because they know whether or not they are wanting to have more self-compassion or not. They don't have to be able to do it. They just have to be wanting it. So
what kind of provider would you need to see to ensure someone was trained effectively to use this with complex chronic conditions?
A loaded question.
Tough one, man. Tough one. We're working really, really hard to produce really great, you know, providers like Andrea. I know Laura already broke off of our clinic and started her own clinic, and she's doing great. Usually there is a board certification process. There's two of them, the BCIA, and then Jay Gaddis is on the board of another board, which I'm forgetting. But those board are kind of a minimum standard. They don't even satisfy the minimum that I would want somebody to have, unfortunately. So that's a really hard question that I don't think I can answer. Watching podcasts like this probably help a lot. You do kind of have to.
Basically, you need to call and talk to somebody. So, like, what it says behind your name isn't going to guarantee.
No, it doesn't. Unfortunately, no.
Call and talk to somebody about the experience they have.
If you go to a clinic and they have one of those black box systems that just does one thing and it's automated, they're going to sound so good if that's the only provider that you've talked to. Okay. When people come to our clinic and they get a brain map, I have them sit right next to me and watch me as I process the data, as I clean the data, as I de-artifact the data, and as I interpret the data. I make them watch me do the whole thing live in front of them so that they will never be fooled by a suboptimal practitioner ever again. So that's kind of the way that I've, that's how I've learned to kind of get ahead of it was they'll never be fooled by any automation. They'll never be fooled by any shortcuts. They'll never be fooled by any kind of black box system because they know what it looks like to do it correctly. Because they watch
so basically
the whole
take all the things we talked about and talk to somebody to find out how individualizing they are and how much they're looking specifically at what's going on.
I would say don't tolerate anybody who uses any kind of automation in the assessment process at all. I wouldn't and I hesitate to name things because you could have some automation that is demonstrative but not evaluative. I do not like any automation in the evaluative process. It can be demonstrative, but it can't be part of the evaluation. If I did something like, we call it Z-scores, which is where it shows you kind of like red is too much, blue is too little, green is just right, and it's kind of giving you a range of what's normal. If you're interpreting those maps, you're wrong. And the reason why is because it doesn't tell you anything about what the mechanisms are. You have to go interpret that in the raw data. So if you don't start in the raw data, if you don't interpret those squiggly lines, you don't really know what that means.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to be wrong half the time. In my experience, it's wrong half the time at least. And I am a little bit embarrassed how many people just go straight to the maps and they read the maps. And it's like, you know, I the amount of consulting I do internationally, and a lot of times it was just them reading the Z-scores and they're not right. Because once you ignore that and go back to the data, it's not what it looks like.
Well, I want to just take the time to thank you both for your time today and making sure that we have a really strong understanding of neurofeedback, its pros, its cons, the things to consider when it comes to addressing PANS and PANDAS. One of the things that I just really love about neurofeedback and homeopathy together is that, like other forms of therapy that we've talked about in some other podcasts too, they can have a really synergistic approach, both with helping the body be more prepared and then going through the process with, you know, using homeopathy in addition to it, they really can have a bit of a synergistic experience. And Andrew, I'm sure, like you shared a little bit, it sounds like that was really your experience. You had a lot of synergy with the two together. All right. So last question, we'll put everything in the show notes, but how can people get in touch with you or learn more about you if they are super curious with everything that you shared?
Well, you can track us down at neurofeedbackcare.com. You can text the main number or call it, or just message us on our website. You were pretty quick about getting back to people. We do consults, for other clinics as well. We have a book, Neurofeedback for All. I'm going to release the second edition here in a week or so. It's going to have a lot more technical stuff.
So by the awesome. Time this is actually live, this That's podcast true. Yeah. live, yeah. it'll actually out. Yep. be available. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. And in maybe the next 6 months, which might be by the time this is out, I don't know. Mm-hmm. We should have like a course for providers who want to learn how to do high level neurofeedback analysis. Mm-hmm. But I would say that I'm going to try and do something complicated. I'm going to try and make it very easy to understand for a beginner, mm-hmm. but I'm going to try to bring the best practice down to the lowest level. Yeah. I don't know. I've never seen anyone. I'm going to make the class I wish I always had. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, mm-hmm. We'll make sure, because we are recording this before, mm-hmm. like a little bit before we're mm-hmm. actually going to have it released. So we'll make sure we update anything in our show notes. We'll mm-hmm. check in with you guys beforehand just awesome. To make sure anything that you have available that we've got access to it in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time and for all of your expertise that you shared with us today. We really appreciate that everything
Thank you so
that you
much.
Shared with us.
Right. Thank you for having us. Good to see you guys. Take have care, a good everybody. One.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Bye.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We would love to connect with you on social media and have you as part of our amazing community. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas.
If Facebook isn't your thing, you can also connect with us on Instagram and YouTube by searching for Resilience Naturopathic or clicking the links in our show notes. You can also visit our website, resiliencenaturopathic.com.
As always, we value your partnership in advocacy and education. Your support through following, sharing, rating, and reviewing our podcast is crucial in our mission to teach the world about PANS, PANDAS, and homeopathy. So if you found this podcast helpful, please leave us a review. Together, we are making a difference.
And finally, this podcast really is for you. Your questions and feedback help us make sure we are answering the right questions so you can feel confident making the next right step for your kids. Send us your questions or request guests by emailing us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com, also linked in the show notes.